What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Sweet Tarts dared to combine sweet and tart. But we didn't stop there. We combined soft and bouncy to bring you new Sweet Tarts Gummies Fruity Splits, a uniquely delicious dual-sided gummy with one side that's sweet and one side that's tart, but entirely smooth and squishy. Mmm, a powerfully perfect combo. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
And welcome to the Music to My Ears podcast, brought to you by BBC Music Magazine, the world's best-selling classical music monthly. This week we talked to Julian Lloyd Webber, one of the world's greatest cellists, who recently celebrated his 70th birthday. Lloyd Webber's early years were spent living in a house that was filled with the music of not only his composer father William, but later his older brother Andrew as well. Julian himself took up the cello as a child, inspired by the great players such as Rostropovich. He later embarked on a glittering career on the world's great stages, followed in more recent years by his appointment as head of the Royal Birmingham Conservatoire. Though an injury has curtailed his solo career, Julian Lloyd Webber still appears on the stages today as a conductor and devotes much of his time to championing music education, plus, of course, supporting his beloved Leyton Orient Football Club. Julian talked to our deputy editor Jeremy Pound shortly before his 70th birthday in April, just as the UK was emerging out of lockdown.
I'm here with Julian Lloyd Webber speaking over Zoom just as the UK starts to come out of lockdown. The weather is very nice at the moment and people are starting to come outside after three fairly heinous months. And Julian has his 70th birthday in 2 weeks from today. I don't presume this is how you really wanted to spend your 70th birthday.
No, but everyone's in the same boat, but it certainly wasn't. And I think we can't, you know, even go out really to celebrate because now everywhere's completely booked up and has to be outdoors. So it doesn't really work, you know, but so I will do some kind of quiet family thing.
Have you found ways of keeping yourself occupied over the last 3 or 4 months?
Yes, I mean, I really have. I have left the Royal Birmingham Conservatoire, where I had a fantastic time over 5 years with wonderful students and a lovely place. But I'm still very involved with music education. I've been speaking out about one or two things. I was on this national music, model music curriculum panel. So that took quite a lot of time. So generally, actually been really busy. I had a big conducting concert coming up next month, well, April, in China, which with a huge program of Mozart, Marriage of Figaro, Overture, Shostakovich, first cello concerto, which would have been fascinating for me to conduct, and the César Franck Symphony. And this was with the Shenzhen Symphony Orchestra, who I know are a very good orchestra. So it's a shame it's been postponed a couple of times now and is still being postponed. So things are not back to normal yet, as we all know.
Now, I want to go back over these 70 years and actually ask you about your life in music. I've done a couple of these interviews where I've interviewed people who have come from very musical backgrounds. Actually, one or two where they haven't at all. But of course, your family is famously musical, with your father, William, a very feted composer, and likewise your brother, Andrew. What was it like growing up in such a astonishingly musically talented family?
Well, it just seemed to be, it was normal to me. You know, when you're growing up as a child, you know, my brother is 3 years older than me. And there was just always this music around. I remember my father, who was still just about composing every morning at that time when I was, I remember him sort of buried away in this room that he had, which was fitted up with the most extraordinary contraption, a pedal piano, which was fitted with pedals like the organ, so he could practice, you know, his organ at home on the piano. It was a very strange device. I've never seen one either before or since, but I'm sure they must exist somewhere. So that was going on. My mother specialised teaching young children the piano, so sometimes, you know, there'd be young children coming and learning from my mum. And then Andrew was always into theatre music and always composing his own tunes. And there were lots of music students coming in all the time. Occasionally my father would take a student at home, and then later on, the pianist John Lill actually came, who was a student at the Royal College of Music like myself, but quite a lot older. But I met him at the junior department there, and he would eventually came to live with us. And so for a long time, he was there practicing all the time. So my knowledge of piano repertoire is really not too bad. you know, certainly all the Prokofiev sonatas, the Beethoven sonatas, he was working on these things all the time. And I was playing cello by that, you know, I've skipped a few years now. I'm sort of thinking of when I was 13, 14, 15, 16, and all these people started coming into the home and actually living with us. And the Andrew's lyricist, Tim Rice, also came and lived with the home. It was bohemian. And that word's been used before about how it was, but it really was. There was extraordinary numbers of people in and out all the time. Lots of young people, my own friends, Andrew's friends, you know, John Lill's friends, in and out all the time. And then there was another two generations, my father and mother, and my grandmother also living at home, actually in the next room to Tim Rice, who, you know, had various girlfriends wandering around in various states of dress or undress. And it was a most extraordinary combination. And I do look back on it with great affection, because it was one of those places where you never knew, you know, what was going to happen next, basically. People say the Lloyd Webber family, it's musical, obviously, but actually before my father, my father's father was he was an amateur singer, and he was a fanatical about the organ, and that's how my father got into playing the organ. He used to take his son around to look at churches with, you know, amazing organs around the place, and obviously particularly in London. And my father then became fanatical about it as well, and started playing, and he was really a child prodigy organist, playing big recitals when he was very young. But before that, there's no sort of record of music in the family.
So how did you choose the cello yourself?
My mother took me. Well, first of all, of course, she tried to start me off on the piano, as that's what she did. She taught children the piano, so she tried with me. I never got on with it. Perhaps it was because it was my mother trying to teach me. But then I was taken to one of those Ernest Reed children's concerts they used to have at the Festival Hall, and I spotted the cello in the orchestra. I would have been about four then, and I thought, this looks interesting. It looks... you can see how the notes are made. You can see how the sound is produced. And I asked if I could play a cello. And then I was very disappointed, because I was thinking that one of those instruments was going to come. And what arrived was a 10th size cello, which was a bit like a violin, basically, a big violin. And so I was a bit disgruntled by this. But then I sat down with this little toy cello and actually really started enjoying it and playing it for fun, which I never had done with the piano. And I went to study in a class, I remember, with this lovely old lady who was a specialist, I suppose my mother's equivalent on the cello, a lady called Alison Dalrymple. And she had this big cello class. I can't remember where it was exactly, somewhere around Notting Hill or something. And I remember that one of the oldest the older players, but she took them right through from, you know, 3-4 to 12, maybe even 16, was Jacqueline Dupre. I mean, I didn't know that at the time, but people told me that after. But there were a lot of very good young cellists there, and she was a sort of expert at teaching young children the cello. But I must say, I didn't really take it seriously. I just played for fun. I never practiced properly, and all that came about much later.
One of your earliest favourite pieces of music, though, I understand, was Shostakovich's first cello concerto. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. A lot of things started to change, I suppose, probably when I was around 11. I got more and more into the cello. I got really into the repertoire of the instrument. So I knew of these concertos that everyone played and, you know, were on the radio all the time, and lots of recordings like Elgar, Saint-Saëns, Dvorak, the Schumann, you know, all the ones we know. And I got fascinated about what else was written for the cello. So I started collecting LPs and things. I often used to go to a wonderful old shop in Wardour Street called the Gramophone Exchange. And they had not only new everything, you know, all the new releases, but they used to have an old loads of secondhand records, and cheap too. And I would go through the cello section probably once a month, and I've still got all some extraordinary old recordings that I bought from that shop and other places as well. But the thing that really changed my mind about the cello, which had just been a hobby, something, you know, that was just another thing in my life, was really when I went. I was taken, first of all, by a teacher called Runa Martin, who was a South African lady, well, young girl, really, was still a student, I think, herself at the Royal College. And she started teaching me at the junior department, and she inspired me. So I would have been around 11 then. And she started taking me to hear, way beyond the call of her duty, some great cellists in concert. Well, this was the first time for me, and I think the very first one that I heard and she took me to was Pierre Fournier, who, strangely in a way, became my teacher later, which I would never have imagined at that age, because I wasn't even thinking particularly of doing this for myself. But I started hearing these great cellists, and it was just a revelation to me in concert. And I always saw the cello as a solo instrument. That's how I heard it. That's how I saw it. And then I started going to these concerts on my own. And when I was 13, I heard Rostropovich for the first time in a concert where he played Dvorak concerto and a first performance with Khachaturian conducting of Khachaturian's Concerto Rhapsody. And I was just blown away. I really was blown away. It's well, kind of annoying expression, but I was. And I started thinking, you know, I want to try to do this for myself. And then I realized, obviously, that I had a huge amount of work to do because I hadn't, spent much time on technique, any time on technique. I wasn't interested in that. And I realized now that I had to. So around that time, I changed to another wonderful teacher called Douglas Cameron. I was still at school. I used to go on Saturday mornings to him over in Chiswick. And he was a wonderful teacher, was at the Royal Academy. So I had private lessons with him while I was still at school till I was 16. Now, he also inspired me greatly. If I look back on my cello teachers, I would say my key teacher was Douglas Cameron. And so I was just getting more and more into the cello and really pretty much stopped doing my schoolwork, I have to say, and coming back home and practicing. And that's what I love to do. And Shostakovich, of course, was a composer who had written at that point this major cello concerto, which was, I think it was 1959, it was premiered. And I would then, I got to know it when I was 12, 13, and I saw him play it in concert. I had the recording. I just thought it was a completely fresh piece of music and a new approach in a way to the cello as a solo instrument. I have to say, looking back now, it's brilliantly written for the cello. I mean, it sounds brilliant, but it actually sounds harder than it is. It's not easy, but it's one of those pieces that's so well written. The double stopping and the fast passage work. It sounds incredibly difficult, but actually it lies very much under the hand. So it just was an approach to the cello where I have to say this, you know, in the first movement, it's almost rock and roll. I mean, he has got these rhythms going on, da da dum dum dun dun dun, and the cello, you know, against it, and this bass line, pizzicato double bass line, you know, and it was just so exciting for a young player of that age. I thought, you know, I would love to be out there playing that piece. And so I started working on it very young, actually. And Cameron said to me, you know, I don't think you're ready for that. I think you should play the sonata. If you want to play Shostakovich, play the sonata instead. It's much more straightforward. So I thought, no, I said, no, I'm going to play the concerto. If you don't mind, I'll come back with you with this next week. And I just sat and practiced that first movement so that he let me go on working at the rest of the concerto. And he did. And he said, okay, all right, you've not done too badly. You can go on with this. So that was it. And I was just into the cello. I went to hear every cellist I could everywhere. And I kept buying the cello recordings, taping things off the radio, reel-to-reel tapes. Whenever I saw there was a piece for cello, I would tape it. And some of the more weird foreign radio stations, because Radio Times in those days used to have this section of music from foreign radio stations. So I would be tuning into Hilversum with lots of cracks and crackles and recording pieces like the Honegger Concerto, you know, concertos that I'd literally never heard of. And I've still got all those old tapes, can't actually play them, but I've got them and I've kept them. And there's some extraordinary performances there by cellists that people wouldn't associate with those pieces of music, perhaps, but I've kept them all.
You were mentioning a couple of the great cellists there, including, of course, Rostropovich. Now, if my maths is correct, you would have been 17 when he famously played Dvorak's cello concertos at the cello concerto at the Proms, fairly soon after the Russian tanks had rolled into the centre of Prague.
You're right.
Tell me a little bit about that.
It was in 1968, and of course I'd been, you know, I was an absolute Rostropovich devotee and been to see every concert that he did in London, if at all possible. And this particular night will forever live in the memory of anyone who was there. Probably that concert should have been cancelled, although, and now, you know, everyone in the end was very glad that it wasn't. But it really just was amazing, because the headline news all over the world was that the Soviet Union had invaded Prague. Now, what perhaps I didn't realise at that time was how important a city Prague was in Rostropovich's life. He won his first cello competition there, I think in 1947. He met his wife Galina there in Prague. It was a very, very special city for Rostropovich. So this terrible event had happened, and he was playing the Czech cello concerto, Dvorak concerto, at the Proms. And it was conducted by Evgeny Svetlanov, who's a conductor I love. And in fact, later on, I did actually get to play Dvorak concerto with Svetlanov. But the two of them didn't get on. there was an extra tension there. They really didn't get on, although I've heard some of the best live Rostropovich performances are, strangely enough, conducted by Svetlanov. And I think there was something about that tension that somehow brought the best out of maybe both of them. Anyway, so this extraordinary thing happening, there were people with banners outside the hall protesting. And I've forgotten to say, it was with the USSR State Symphony. I mean, it couldn't have been, you couldn't make it up, actually. And there were people, promos, shouting and before the concerto began. I remember they started off with Ruslan and Ludmila by Glinka. I can't find that performance anywhere, but it was the fastest performance I've ever heard, perhaps of anything ever. It was just crazy, and Svetlana whipping the orchestra up, and the tension in the hall was just amazing before Rostropovich came on. And then, of course, you would say, I mean, if you hear that performance now, which has been released and is quite easy to hear, I think it's on YouTube, I think it's around the place, you would never say it was technically his best performance. He's quite overwrought, and as it gets nearer the end of the concerto, he skims over the passage work. It's like he almost, you know, can't bear to be there, actually, and wishes he wasn't there. There are moments when I feel that, but then when it comes to the end, which he always played so wonderfully anyway, it's absolutely heartbreaking. It's incredibly slow. Svetlana's following him like, you know, perhaps, I don't know. Anyway, it's incredibly emotional. It was an extraordinary experience to be there and see that concert. And then Rostropovich did a Bach encore, and he had tears coming down his face. And it was one of those things, really, where music does speak louder than words. People he could never say in an interview as a Soviet cellist what he felt, but he certainly said it through his music that night.
Now, strange enough, the concert you have chosen, though, the highlight is a really memorable one, as well as that which you attended, was a prom in 2007, a much more upbeat prom, and this was the Simon Bolivar Orchestra under Gustavo Dudamel.
Well, I was invited to that concert, I can't exactly remember why I was there, but it, in a sense, it changed my life in a way, because it was the most astonishing performance, and they really were, they were the Simon Bolivar Youth Orchestra at that point, and they really were very young players. I think as the orchestra toured the world, many of those players seemed to stay on, and they dropped the word youth out of it. But at that point, they were all very young players from Venezuela, with this incredible dynamic ball of fire young conductor. And again, Shostakovich comes into this, because the main work in the program was Shostakovich's 10th Symphony, which I always loved. And I just, everybody in that hall that night was completely, again, blown away by the performance of this young orchestra. That's not actually, and I'd like to say this at this point, that's not to say that, you know, the National Youth Orchestra, for example, is not as good. I think in many ways they are. But it was the fact that a lot of these children had come, it was the thing that really appealed to me, is I've always believed music's for everyone. And you saw these young children from Venezuela, and many of them were from very poor backgrounds. There's people who now start nitpicking, saying, actually, Dudamel was a middle-class Venezuelan. I mean, come off it. You know, there were people from extremely poor backgrounds, and I've been there, and and when Caracas was slightly more safe than it is now, I played with that orchestra later, and it's a wonderful, really thing that has happened for the children there. I hope it's still okay. I don't know. But it was an incredible program for these children, and they embraced that music with the most incredible enthusiasm. And the fact that some of them, I think that one of them went on to be principal bass in the Berlin Philharmonic. I mean, to create that in Venezuela, which was a country that had no real meaningful tradition of classical music, it was all very stale. And now, or certainly then, it completely came alive. And Dudamel was as well known in Venezuela as any president or any, you know, he was. I like to see that with classical music. I like to see the public getting behind it and loving a player, loving and identifying with someone as really an absolutely essential part of their culture. So anyway, this prom was just joyous. It was a wonderful experience. And I guess that is, you've hit the nail really, why I would choose that, because it was joyous. It was celebrating classical music. And the concert of Rostropovich was for different reasons special, but they weren't joyous reasons at all. So that's why I would perhaps just edge the Simon Bolivar concert.
And the Simon Bolivar concert, of course, that led you to start or get going with In Harmony as well.
Yes, I remember that night that I was sitting in a box with the music editor of the arts editor of the Observer, Vanessa Thorpe, and I was saying to Vanessa, you know, we. If they can do that in Venezuela, we should be doing this here. We should be, you know, really making sure that all young children are learning instruments. And she said, well, do you want to do an interview about that? And I said, yes. And so there was a big interview with us saying, well, you know, why aren't we doing this here, basically? Then I get a call from the schools minister in the Labour government, Andrew Adonis, and saying, okay, come in and talk about it. And we did. And then the programme In Harmony was born. And I chaired its steering committee, and lots of very helpful people, knowledgeable people about schools and education sat on this committee. And we came up in the end with lots of interview processes and all this with three programmes, one in Norwich, one in Liverpool, and one in Lambeth. And I watched that grow. And it is now, I think it's in 12 schools now. It's gone through probably four regime changes, shall we say that? And it's still there. And the reason it's still there is because it's produced results and it has changed children's lives, not only children's lives, the whole performance of those schools it's in. And, you know, school, I don't particularly want to single out, but I know there's one school that was virtually in special measures, is now outstanding. You know, that's the transformation that music can bring about in a school. And I'm hoping that this new model music curriculum, which I was also on that panel, will do the same, because it is recommending, more or less, more than recommending, there has to be an hour's music in every school starting very soon. And this is something which is new, and I hope really will start to make a difference.
One piece of music which I notice has been a constant throughout your whole career and has clearly meant a lot to you, and you actually wrote a piece about it for BBC Music Magazine a couple of years ago, is Elgar's Cello Concerto. Why, above all other works, has that held a sort of life or career-long obsession for you?
It has just been, I suppose, in many ways, the most important piece of music in my life. At very many special occasions, it was the Elgar that I was playing. So it's been a constant thread, really. Um, I It wasn't the first cello concerto I learned. I think that was the Saint-Saëns. I came to it as a cellist in a way slightly late, probably when I was about 16. And, you know, it's not late, but it seemed late to me because it wasn't one of the earliest ones I learned. And in fact, the work that really got me into Elgar was the First Symphony. I'd seen Barbarolli conduct this at the Festival Hall, and I then was, you know, just fell in love with Elgar's music, really. Obviously, I knew pieces, some of the smaller pieces, like Serenade for Strings, before. But it was really the First Symphony that made me love Elgar, a work of so many contrasting moods, so many contrasting emotions, wonderful opening melody, wonderful ending, gorgeous themes in the first movement particularly, and very, to me, connected to the countryside. And I started, I'll tell you, digress here, but I used to pick up my father's Mini. I just learned how to drive, and I would drive often with the Celia, who became my wife about 6-7 years later. We would drive out to basically Elgar country, or try to get as far as we could, because that was quite far from London, especially those days, and far for the car too, which was secondhand and struggled a bit. But I would do that, and I fell in love with that part of the country as well. And I do feel with Elgar that it's not essential, but it's an advantage to know the Malvern Hills and to know that area he loved so well. You had a sense of the line, the incredible long musical lines he had with, which the contours are hilly, you know, they're not flat. And I think that's a sort of side observation. But the piece has been very important to me. I made my Festival Hall debut with it. And I think there's one concert in my career that I remember more vividly than any other. And it was the final changeover concert in Hong Kong, from British to Chinese rule in Hong Kong. And this would have been in, whenever it was, 1997, was it? I don't know. Anyway, my history.
Yes, it was 97. It was
97.
Yeah, spring of 97, yes.
So I was due to go out there and play this concert. I knew it was going to be something special, because obviously an extraordinary, end of an era. So I went out with the Academy of St. Martin's and lovely Neville Mariner. And the first half was all English, the Academy and Mariner, myself, ending the first half with the Elgar. The second half was the Chinese conductor Yu Long with the Chinese orchestra and a brand new piece of Chinese music. So it really was that. The end of the Elgar was the end of that era. And all the politicians were there. I remember Chris Patton from England, all the Chinese, all of them were all there. And of course, with the situation now, perhaps you could see just how emotive that evening was. And as it, I knew it was going to be special, but I didn't know it would feel like that. So as the Elgar, you know, the closing bars of that Elgar, which are incredibly emotional at any time, in that hall on that night, I never forget the sort of the incredible tension and a sense of sadness in the air. So just a, generally, that piece has been, and of course the recording I made with Yehudi, who I loved working with, and we played it a lot around the world, they're very special memories for me.
Do you still head out to the Malvern Hills occasionally and kind of get the Elgar vibe?
Yes. I mean, basically, our house is in the Cotswolds. It's not exactly Elgar country, but it's very near. And I think, people would talk about the Malverns quite rightly. But I think he also had a great soft spot for Hereford and that area, and going right to the Welsh borders. I mean, you've got the Welsh tune in the introduction, Allegro, and I think he loved that. And he wrote, of course, some of his greatest works while he was living in Hereford, which I think he was there for about 10 years, which in Elgar's term is one of the longest stays he probably ever had anywhere, because he was always moving house. I can quite understand why. I'm actually a closet Hereford United supporter, but don't tell my friends at Lake Norrent.
Okay, I promise not to. Actually, I was only yesterday, I went up one of the hills just south of Cheltenham for a walk with some friends. And from there, you can see the Malverns on the horizon, this very dramatic hillside, isn't it? It's quite a bare... It's not classic English countryside, the Malverns, at all, is it?
No, not at all. And it is quite bare, and the areas with very few trees, and it's windswept. And I hear that in his music. Listen to the second movement of the First Symphony. Those semiquavers. It's like it's gusts of wind. It's fresh air. And I feel that in the second movement of the Cello Concerto too. And the way he marks it with the little hairpins, it's like it's open air, it's outdoor music.
And of course, one performer who's had a sort of, I wouldn't say a stranglehold on the work, but who's just become very associated with the work is, of course, Jacqueline Dupré. And you wrote a piece of music called A Song for Jackie much later, didn't you?
Yes. I mean, I got to know Jacqueline Dupré quite... She was the cellist probably I heard most when I was growing up in London, because, you know, she was the young star, and she was playing a lot, and I heard her play a lot in London. But I didn't get to know her until she was quite ill, very ill with multiple sclerosis, and I got to know her really quite well then, and she was still full of joy, you know, still full of fun, and cracking jokes all the time, you know, which is something that shows the strength of character that she had. So then I was invited to a preview of this film, Hilary and Jackie, which had been based on a book that she'd written with her sibling Piers, and Hilary Dupré is her sister, and Piers Dupré is her brother, and they wrote this book, which I felt was unrecognisable from the person I knew, and I think I don't really want to say the reasons why they wrote this. All I can say is that they wrote the book apparently alongside the screenplay for the film. There were awful things that happened. I got to know, firstly, the film was, I think, just basically dishonest. And you know, there's one place which I know as a cellist, and everyone would know, where they show her leaving her Stradivarius outside in the snow in Moscow when she was learning with Rostropovich, because she was so depressed. And all, you know, that never, ever, ever would happen. And their instrument would have died if that had happened, and it didn't. So come on. And there was the incidents, you know, with her talking at a hospital in front of someone that could not possibly be verified, because the person she was talking in front of had died. So I just felt the film was fundamentally dishonest. So I've written very few pieces of music, but I came back home that day after the film in a sort of white rage. And wrote this little tune, which is, you know, no great claims about it, but it tried to sum up the way I felt about her.
I want to move now onto your current listening obsession, because although I should imagine you're very wide ranging in your listening taste, not least because of your recent post at the Birmingham Conservatoire. Are there any composer or any particular music which you find you're constantly coming back to at the moment?
Yes, and it would be Mozart. And people might say, well, this is very strange. You know, he's not played Mozart, but I couldn't because Mozart never wrote for cello. So it's been, apart from the very good parts in some of the string quartets and the wonderful string quintet with two violas, two violins, and cello in G minor, which I think is one of his greatest works. I was as soon as I got some chance to do some conducting, I asked to do Mozart, and with the Orchestra of the Swan, I did quite a few concerts. And I did Mozart 40. That's the first one I wanted to do because I just think it's a total masterpiece. And then I did the Mozart 29, also in G minor, and I just love Mozart. You know, I played a lot of his music when I was younger. I played in the string quintet. I played in the oboe quartet. I played the clarinet quintet. But obviously, there's no solo cello music. Yes, unfortunate mistake in Mozart's life there. But I love his music, and I think, you know, I'm fascinated listening to performances of, say, for example, Mozart 40. And I'm so glad, you know, actually it was Neville Marriner was one of the ones who came along and swept away this over-romantic tradition where you're playing with sort of like 10 double basses in the Berlin Philharmonic. It's crazy. And I think people listen, there's two composers I think you don't mess with. You don't mess with the music and try and keep it as simple as possible. Mozart, Shostakovich. Play what they've written. Play the dynamics they've written. Don't romanticize them. You know, that to me, what they have written down is extremely clear. And I've always said that to students, come and play Shostakovich concerto to me or sonata. And, you know, don't romanticize it. Don't put writs in where they're not written. You know, just play this music and it will work. And I feel the same with Mozart.
Would you say, if you had to pick out, and this is the impossible question, if there was one symphony which you had to pick out above all others, would it be number 40, perhaps?
Yes.
Because?
Genius. It's a work of absolute genius. The way it ends, I find, is interesting because it's not a sort of, in a way, big ending. There's so much range of emotion in that symphony. Hurt, anger. I think the ending of the symphony is angry. And that's why I hate to hear writs and things. He doesn't write that. He wants to go straight through to the end. I think there's so much. Why I would pick that one out is because it is an absolute example of the best of the human spirit. It's a wonderful work with teeming with ideas and very original for that time. And there's that part in the last movement, which is actually atonal. I mean, at that time, when he wrote that, that must have been an extraordinary listening to an audience.
Finally, one subject I have to talk about, because we are both big football fans, as you have mentioned earlier on.
Now, and Jeremy, do you know that there's a book called Shostakovich and Football?
I have read it. It's brilliant.
See, there's far more links between, I think, musicians and football than people realise. I mean, I was just talking to my dear friend Sheku Kane Mason, and his manager is really worried that he takes his football so seriously and actually, you know, keeps playing as a striker for the Royal Academy football team. Because I think, you know, and he said to me, well, actually, I did break my wrist once, and just before the BBC competition, the time before he won it. Good for him. He's down to earth, and long may it last.
Though sadly, he supports Arsenal, which you and I will both have to find some way of forgiving.
I would rather overlook this. Now, I try not to let it spoil our friendship. It's also the same affliction that my son has got. I don't understand it. I try to bring him up the right way, but you know.
Presumably, as a proper football fan, one of the things you're looking forward to most coming out of lockdown is next season spending happy afternoons on windswept, rainy terraces in Crawley and Harrogate and Barrow and places like that.
No, I hope we'll be in League One by then. So places like Oxford. Although you might even be in the Championship, who knows? But there we go. This is the joy of football. The actual thing is that, you know, within how many seasons it would be possible for Leighton Orient to be playing Manchester, one of the Manchester teams in the Champion in League One. It is a possibility, isn't it? I mean, Premier League. So that's the joy of football. I think musicians need other outlets. Music is so all-consuming that I used to like to go to football because it was so completely different to everything else I was doing. Mm. And Elgar did too. And Shostakovich. Yeah. So we're in really, really good company.
Absolutely. So that brings our conversation to a rather nice close. Thank you very much indeed for your time, Julian. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you. Lovely to talk to you.
Likewise.
That was cellist Julian Lloyd-Webber talking to our deputy editor Jeremy Pound. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast from the team at BBC Music Magazine. Tune in next week when we'll be speaking to another fascinating figure from the musical world about their enduring musical loves. Do let us know what you think of the podcast by rating and reviewing it wherever you've been listening. If you want to find out more about BBC Music Magazine, we're available in print and various digital formats across the world. Or you can visit our website, classical-music.com, where you can read about all the latest music happenings, read thousands of reviews and a good deal more. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.